As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
This is Talk of the Devils, the Athletics podcast dedicated to Manchester United. I'm Ian Irving, and what a treat we have today. A full house on Talk of the Devils. Good morning, Carl Anker.
Morning, mate. How are you getting on?
I'm good. Good morning, Andrew Mitten.
Good morning, mate. Looking forward to this.
Good morning. And, wow, good morning, Laurie Whitwell.
I thought you were going to give him a full name there, because you gave Andrew Mitten. It's Lawrence Whitwell. I thought you were going to give me the full title, Ian, but I'm great to be here.
Yeah, I just wouldn't do that to anyone calling them Lawrence, mate. No wonder you shorten it.
Do you know why? My mum loves Little Women. I probably shouldn't admit to this. Do you know the character Laurie on Little Women, the guy?
Oh, sorry, it's a TV program.
It's a book!
Oh, is it? Oh,
and a lovely film, actually.
It's a great film.
Film. Timothy Chalamet. The leads one. Anyway, yeah.
I've got absolutely no idea what you're talking about. Andy, have you any idea?
No, you might as well be talking in Swahili for all I know. I've no idea what this thing is.
Properly recommended.
I think we better move on and talk about stuff that we all know about. I mean, it's been a great start.
It is World Book Day as well.
It's World Book Day. What an appropriate start. We all knew that, didn't we? And that's why we did that little aside at the start. But during the course of Talk of the Devils today, we're going to preview the Manchester Derby this weekend. We're going to talk about the form of Marcus Rashford heading into it, who of course has been a Derby hero on many occasions. And we'll also round up the best of the rest from The Athletic, speaking about free kicks, speaking about the UEFA Youth League, speaking about Lee Sharp and Manchester United's search for a new manager and the very latest on that. But let's start then by previewing the game on Sunday. It's a huge match. It's one of the matches we always look forward to every single year, especially those in and around the city of Manchester, as the city is divided into red and blue once more. And actually, it's 5 years ago this month. Incredible, this. I can't believe it's 5 years ago, but it's 5 years ago this month that Marcus Rashford became the youngest Manchester Derby goalscorer in Premier League history, scoring the winner at the Etihad Stadium, aged just 18 years and 141 days.
Rashford, he's in here, he scores! Marcus Rashford takes yet another step up the ladder, and it's a lad from Manchester.
What a moment that was, absolutely incredible. Andy, as if it's 5 years ago, by the way.
No, time flies, doesn't it? I'd like to say when you're having fun, but it hasn't been a funny 5 years for Manchester United. Not won a trophy for 5 years coming up. But I remember that clearly. And buzzing off it, I think Marcus was the only Mancunian on the pitch, and it was a great finish. He was a young lad, and part of me is quite sorry because Marcus's stock has fallen since then in terms of his performances. I'd love to see him back to a level where he was. I remember the day after that game, I got on a flight from Manchester to Barcelona, and as I walked through the front of the cabin, even though it was a budget airline, lots of Manchester City senior officials were on the plane because lots of them are Catalans who live in Barcelona, and I recognize them and I don't know them, and I pretended to make a phone call and say, no, we won, we did them 1-0, yep, a Mancunian scored it, brilliant, the whole city's buzzing. And I realize it's very, very immature of me to do that, but that's just me. I'm sorry, that's what I'm like. I enjoyed it, and I'm sure they were thinking, what a knob. But I enjoyed it, and if it happens again, I'll do exactly the same thing. So watch out for it, Ferran Soriano.
Yeah, I'm sure he's listening. He's a big fan of our podcast, I'm sure. Laurie, yeah, his stock has fallen a little bit of late, but it's easy to forget, in a sense, really, just how incredible Rashford was at that point and how he was sort of doing things that no young Mancunian striker had done for Manchester United before.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love Andy's story there. It just brings back memories of Dom Jolly, you know, with his massive, big, whatever mobile phone it was, annoying people. So Andy, yeah, I can totally picture the scene. But I think what you're talking about there actually is probably the enjoyment that you got from a guy like Marcus Rashford coming through the academy and scoring such a really good goal, a winning goal at the Etihad, showing no fear. I mean, he went through a ridiculous run, didn't he, of scoring on his debut in the Premier League, FA Cup, for England. It was ridiculous, wasn't it, this kind of run that he was on. And I mean, to be fair, he has delivered in sort of big moments, you know, and it's perhaps not been as frequent as people would have liked. There were certainly moments, you know, in that 2019-20 season where he kind of carried the team. And I actually watched that Manchester derby at the Etihad when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's job was pretty much on the line. He had that sort of back-to-back winning sequence against Tottenham and Man City. I watched that match with a guy called David Horrocks, who's Fletcher Moss's chairman, which is the boys' club that Marcus Rashford came through. So I went to his house, really lovely guy. And the match went perfectly for the piece because, you know, Rashford was on fire. United played really well. And then at the end, Rashford's taking his shirt off, going into the crowd. I think Jesse Lingard was there as well, doing the same thing. And he played a little bit for Fletcher Moss when he was a young kid. And it was really lovely seeing this guy that had obviously first met Marcus when he was, you know, 7, 8 years old. I think he used to give Melanie's mum lifts sometimes to training, you know, he used to help out a little bit. And he was just so kind of paternalistic, I suppose, in saying, oh, look, Marcus has got his shirt off, and how excited he was. And so I think that we have to hold on to that kind of picture because he is a Manchester lad. And if we can get a team where you've got just a few of those, you know, golden nuggets in there, it kind of makes those stories, those moments all the more special because you feel a bit of a connection there. Hopefully I'm not getting too romantic about this kind of thing, but I do think that's ultimately what football comes down to.
I don't think there's anything better, no matter which team you support anywhere in the world, than a local lad who's followed the club from being really small, come through the academy, broken into the first team and made an impact. I just think there's nothing better than that. And whichever team you're at, whoever your youngster is, to see that and to witness that, that's one of us doing that, effectively. And I think that's why it brings such romantic and such just brilliant feeling, really, isn't it? I don't really know any other way of summing it up. The flip side of that, Carl, I suppose, is that you celebrate those moments more because Marcus is a local lad. But then does he get more criticism when things are bad because he's a local lad? What do you think?
I think it's a tricky one. Obviously, I'll preface this with, you know, I helped write his book, so I get any conflict of interest there. When you look at this Manchester United team and you look at the 5 years of inconsistent, oh, maybe they're going to get serious and maybe not, and you look at the players who've been there for ages and have like really come up in the big moments, a lot of those big moments have Rashford in them. You talk about the PSG game, you talk about the games against City, you talk about big games in Europe. Rashford is there or thereabouts, and he has played a ridiculous amount of football in these 5 years. You know, he's openly talked about how when he was growing up, he looked up to Cristiano Ronaldo and looked up to Wayne Rooney. There's the story about how he was there for when the Brazilian Ronaldo scored a hat-trick at Old Trafford in the Champions League. So, and he's got all that memory as well. And you can tell he gets properly fired up for the derby. He gets properly heated up when he wants to play against Liverpool. And his goal record against City is pretty good. He's played 14 times. He's got 4 goals and whatnot. And I think the interesting thing is, in terms of criticism, yeah, when it is that big game and he doesn't have a great game, you're almost expecting, wait, but Rashford normally comes good at these games. We've seen him score against Liverpool. We've seen him score against PSG. We've seen him play with absolutely no fear against all these big teams. And when he doesn't have that great moment, you almost feel stung by it. I remember, you know, it was for England, but when he came up for that penalty against Italy, I remember very confidently going to Jack Pitt Brook, who covers Spurs saying Rashford doesn't miss penalties. This is going in. And when when the penalty didn't go in, I pretty much collapsed like that scene out of Boondock Saints. So it does always surprise me when Rashford has one of those great opportunities in a big moment and he doesn't come off, because he's come through so many times when he probably shouldn't have. And you have those moments where you're like, oh, wait, you are human.
Has he recovered from that penalty?
If the opportunity to take another penalty comes up for Manchester United, I'm pretty confident in saying he's not going to shy away from that opportunity if it's offered
to
him.
No, he's proved his strength of character in that regard. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the thing about him, Laurie, I suppose, this season, and I've just hesitated there before picking my words, really, because it's not been straightforward for him, has it, really? He's not had a great season so far for a number of reasons. Are we any closer to seeing him emerge from this period, Laurie? What do you think?
Really don't know, because there's still such flux, isn't there, at Manchester United, with Ralph Rangnick trying to pick the best team, and it seems that, you know, his mind changes. You know, we saw Anthony Elanga come on against Atletico Madrid and make a real impact. So then he keeps his place against Watford. And that's kind of the debate, I suppose, for the Manchester derby, isn't it? You've got another academy player coming through who's kind of on that arc that Rashford was when he first emerged. So, you know, what's the balance there with those two players? But I think because he has the positions kind of altered, it's sort of right or left. Although I suppose you kind of say, well, listen, you know, if you're a forward, you should be able to sort of manipulate in different positions. You look at Man City, you know, they play all over the place, don't they? Liverpool, it's more set. And I suppose the difference with Man City is that actually they've got a team full of players that know their roles. It's understanding, they've got coordination. Whereas at Man United, if you change your position, then it's perhaps not necessarily such an easy transition. I think we've seen, certainly in recent games against Watford, for example, he came off the bench and put a real shift in. You know, you could see him running about, and that's probably one of the criticisms, I think, that we've seen this season. How can we see physically this desire, this love for the game that I think we first saw when he broke through? And I think you perhaps could also say on the flip side of that, it does get clouded in football. It's such a brutal industry. And you have managers that perhaps, you know, want different things from you, and there's been a lot of change at Manchester United. To get that consistency performance perhaps is quite difficult, but ultimately he does have to look at himself. The only way he can get through this kind of dip that he's had is by reapplying himself and absolutely adhering to what Ralph Rangnick asks him to do, showing that determination and desire that got him into this position in the first place. But I think he's got that within him, hasn't he? You can see that he wants to still be the guy for Manchester United, and it's just, it's been such a season of kind of, you know, disappointment all round, really, that I think he's kind of become a part of that problem rather than it being on him himself.
Yeah, sometimes from the outside it feels like he wants to be that person too much, and he tries too hard to take games by the scruff of the neck and really sort of try to be the man for Manchester United.
Rashford has a very obvious tell when he's trying to take the game by the scruff of the neck. So, you know, we know he likes the knuckleball technique. He does it on free kicks and whatnot because he's, you know, big fan of Ronaldo. And he often has a moment in around about the second half of games where he will try and cut inside on the left and just let fly a knuckleball shot. Sometimes it works, you know, hits the woodwork or is on target, but a lot of time it goes wide. But that genuinely seems to be his big sort of, I'm going to have a go. You can tell there, you know, there maybe two or three times in a game, I think this happened against Atletico Madrid, where he sort of had a moment and it didn't quite work. And he sort of like got a bit frustrated, and you could see him sort of, the cogs were turning his head, and he went, right, the next time I get the ball, I'm going to shoot, regardless of, you know, whether or not a passing opportunity is on. He gets the ball in the second half and then has a go with that knuckleball, and it wasn't from a great shooting position. I don't think that either goes in or everyone goes, why'd you shoot from there? He does that two or three times. There are times when it does go in and it's amazing. There was a little spell where, I don't want to read into it too much, but he did it against Spurs when they had a former Manchester United manager in charge. So
yes, I think Rashford stepped up that day. I remember that very well. Andy, would you start him against City?
I don't know. I think his stock's probably at its lowest point since he broke through to the first team. I'd love him to be a great player for Manchester United. I'll always remember Manchester City's manager Pep Guardiola telling somebody, Marcus Rashford is the only player I would take from that club who I think could improve Manchester City. That's 3.5 years ago since he said that now. This season has not been a good one for him. He started it with an injury. He's played in 4 different positions. I'm not sure that can be easy for him. He's played on the left, he's played on the right, he's played as a centre forward, he's played as a second striker. I don't think his career trajectory has been as he would have hoped. He's 24 years old now. He looks frustrated to me and has done a lot of times. Again, it can't be easy playing under different managers. And I don't think he makes himself an automatic starter for the Derby game because he's not been playing well. I'd love him to do what Anthony Martial did in the Derby last year when he was totally out of favour and ended up being Manchester United's man of the match. Love it to come good for Marcus, but it's not been a good season for him. And when Ralf Rangnick is looking at the team, does he think this is Marcus who has produced those great moments, and that there has been a lot of them. And Carl's right to pick out one which often don't get talked about, but Granada away in the Europa League last year, his control was incredible. And I remember speaking to some people who've been on the bench after that game, and they just said he's got that in him. He can produce that moment, bang, control a ball. Top players can do that. I just don't think we're seeing it enough.
You bear in mind, you scored that goal. I think he's in the midst of that really bad ankle injury. Yeah. So
I know there's mitigating factors.
The only time he could wear shoes was when he was wearing football boots. His ankle was that swollen. He's played a lot of football while injured for United because there was no other option. This is the first time in Rashford's career where he actually can be sat down. Not just for, you need a rest for tactical reasons, which Solskjaer didn't really do, but also for personnel reasons. And I think that's a very interesting crossroads for any footballer in their career, not just Rashford. And it's the how do you cope or get your spot back? Jadon Sancho's doing really well on the left-hand side right now. He's one form player. And on the other, on the other flank, it's Anthony Elanga.
It's one reason why Rangnick chooses Elanga. He just thinks that he follows instruction. And Carl said he's played a lot of football this season. He's played a lot of football. He's played 46 times for England and he's 24 years old, Marcus. And I think fans are revisionist over former players. They forget that Ryan Giggs had bad seasons, not just bad months, bad seasons. But fans, when they look back, obviously a great, great player, great servant for the club, they tend to remember the positives and not the negatives. Marcus is not having a good time of it. I'd love him to get out of it. I don't know how he gets out of it. Do you think he's happy, Carl? You think he's happy playing at Manchester United?
I think so. When we came into this season, and Rafael Varane's come in, Jadon Sancho's been signed, Ronaldo comes in at the end of the summer window. Bear in mind, Rashford's rehabbing his shoulder. You look at that team sheet and you go, the best version of that team is probably Rashford on the left, Sancho on the right hand side, Ronaldo up top. And then it just didn't really happen, right? Rashford comes back probably early from recovery from that shoulder surgery. And his first game is off the bench against Leicester City, which is the beginning of the downward slide and trajectory for Solskjaer. He's once again thrown into more dysfunction at Man United. And he's once again being asked, can you fix this? Which he had done previously. And I think he's just, unfortunately, got lost in the shuffle because Sancho's come out. Sancho's, because of the problems at right back at Manchester United, Sancho probably needs to play on the left-hand side right now, which means Rashford needs to go on the right-hand side. I've spoken on this podcast how I think Rashford's really good on the right-hand side, but also I think the thing United do where they constantly allow Sancho and Rashford to swap isn't helpful for Rashford. I think if you're going to play him on the right, just keep him on the right-hand side for 90 minutes. So he doesn't constantly go, I can cut inside. I can't. Because I think he just prefers clarity. And I think the best Marcus Rashford games, if you look at it, are when he's got the clearest vision of what to do in the game. So if you think about games like against Liverpool on the Jose Mourinho, his whole job was attack the space, Trent Alexander-Arnold leaves, cut inside, shoot. And he did that twice and he scored twice. Or when he has games against City or when he has games against Granada, he has a very simple job. Whereas I think when he came into this season, he had maybe one too many jobs because United are just completely collapsing. And then Rangnick comes in, who wants a different set of instructions.
I think you've touched on an interesting point there, Carl, in the fact that since Marcus has been a first-team player in the last 6 years, Laurie. He's had Louis van Gaal with a set idea of how he wants his players to play. He's had Jose Mourinho with a set idea of how he wants his players to play. He's had Ole Gunnar Solskjaer with a different idea of how he wants his players to play. Now he's got Ralf Rangnick with a different idea again. That there aren't many lads who have played the number of games that he has at this age who has had to deal with all these different ideas going around his head all the time. Maybe making slight excuses considering all the other players have had to deal with this as well. But Marcus has been one of the constants throughout that time. Is that an issue, do you think? Do you think the fact that he still doesn't feel like he's got a specialist position, do you think the fact that he's not had a sort of stable coaching throughout his time has had an effect and we're starting to see the result of that?
Yeah, I think so. And that's fair to say. We did a piece earlier this season after, I think it was the Wolves game, wasn't it, where he sort of didn't run for a rebound from a Jadon Sancho shot when, you know, it kind of looked really bad. It kind of looked, did he want to go for that ball? What's going on with Marcus? So we kind of did a piece on that. And one of the things that kind of came out was this idea that, you know, the coaching at United has been changed, you know, from season to season almost. And you look at someone like Raheem Sterling at Man City, who's had Pep Guardiola for what, 5-6 years maybe now, and he's had that consistency. And people might say, well, I think Marcus Rashford's actually a more skilled individual than Raheem Sterling perhaps, but actually Sterling knows what he needs to do for Man City in that team. He obviously, you know, he has to work hard as well, so there's that. That's the one thing that maybe, you know, the pressing that Marcus Rashford sometimes does, I think, can be better, you know, in terms of the way that it's targeted or the kind of intensity of it. But then it takes the whole team to do that. So it's like, you know, if he goes and somebody else doesn't, then, you know, he might then think, okay, well, do I do it next time? You know, that kind of uncertainty. So you need a whole team collectively doing it. And that's probably where Sterling benefits from it, you know, because you've got a guy like Pep Guardiola, genius manager, genius coach, that absolutely demands that of his players as a rule. I think equally, you know, he probably does need just like a moment to kind of consider his game. What is he absolutely brilliant at? And do more of that. I think Carl touched on the kind of shot against Atletico where you're looking at that thinking, no, please don't shoot from there. It was like 40 yards out. You know, the chance of scoring is so minimal. Keep possession of the ball and try and sort of work space a little bit better. So those moments where you think perhaps when he was coming through as a sort of teenager and he did stuff off the cuff and it was brilliant and you're kind of going, wow, do more of that. I think now obviously his game needs to be different just because he's more mature and, you know, it can't happen all the time that you have a shot and it goes in.
I don't really want to bring this up, but I know people will be thinking along these lines, Carl, so I think we should address it. The idea that all the things that he's done off the pitch, all the incredible impact that he's made in society, things like doing the book with yourself, has had some effect on Rashford's form. Can we just put that to bed, please? Will you answer the criticism?
Yeah. Again, I helped write his book. I'm currently helping him write another book, World Book Day and all that. But I'd say his commitment to Manchester United and football is steadfast, right? So there's been more than one incident where, you know, we're having a chat and he's like, hang on, I've got to go do Manchester United things. I think football was allowed to have lives, and Solskjaer spoke about that quite eloquently during the closed door football. He said this was really hard for his players because they weren't, he said, being a good football player means you have to be boring, means you have to get enough sleep, means you have to not really go outside too often, and maybe once a week and once every other month you can go to the cinema or you can go to a restaurant with friends. And to be a good Man United player, you have to be steadfastly boring. Don't think Rashford incredible political campaigning and trying to get hundreds of thousands of children fed and help with their literacy is making him a poorer football player. I would say what Laurie said, which is there's been massive managerial dysfunction. He's been told varying things by varying coaches. You remember his debut goal for Michelin. Louis van Gaal comes out the game, you know, at full time and says, this young Rashford boy, he's good. But at half time, I basically told him to stand within the width of the 6-yard box. And that's how he wants to operate. And then that was what he did against van Gaal, which is basically just stand really central and just apply one-touch finishes. Mourinho comes in and he's like, right, you're on the left now, and then you're going to be basically a second striker. Solskjaer comes in, says you're on the left, but also allows loads of freedom and interpretation. And now Rangnick's come in and goes, right, sometimes you're on your left, sometimes you're on the right. You're allowed to swap with Jadon Sancho during certain periods of time. It's going to be really important for you to track back. What do you mean no one's told you how to track back? Okay, now I have to teach you what to track back is. It's more than just running in a negative direction. You have to run at certain angles and curve your bending runs and talk to other teammates and whatnot. So I think that's the difficult thing. I had a look at Rashford's last minute winners for Man United because he scored four. He scored four 90-minute goals after the 90th minute for Manchester United. That's the highest in United history. It's the highest in Premier League history. And three of those goals have come from coming off the bench. One of those goals came from him starting on the right-hand side. Two of those goals came after Mourinho. One of them's a lucky, weird deflection against Bournemouth. If you look at all the post-match press conference comments about Rashford, and he can just keep doing this. I think what's become quite interesting about United and Rashford is they've got a very talented local lad who very clearly loves the football club. And I'm sure there's people who listen to this podcast who play FIFA or Football Manager, and there's loads of stuff. If you play, go in the games, you can't buy Marcus Rashford. He just will not leave. And it's one of those weird bugs that if he does leave or go to City, everyone's like, hang on, no, the game's broken. That's like the perception of Rashford. And I think a lot of United fans can't imagine Marcus Rashford playing somewhere else because he loves the club. Sometimes I feel as if, you know, if it's quite odd that he's never really been the number one guy at United, even though he is loved by United fans, right? You think about, he comes through at 18, you're like, okay, one day he'll be the starting striker. And you're like, oh, wait, he hasn't nailed down a position. But he'll be a consistent starter sometimes. And it's the thing of, United have never really built a whole team of Marcus Rashford. And, I mean, this is very much dependent on your perspective. Has Rashford ever hit that long, consistent spell where you go, United should build a team around Marcus Rashford? And I think that's the difficult thing. I think that's the confusing thing about Marcus Rashford is that he's 5, maybe 6 years on. We're still not quite sure about his best position. We're still not quite sure about what to do next. I mean, United can't score many goals right now, and Rashford scored loads of goals for Man City. And yet, if you ask most United fans, would you play Rashford up top as the number nine against City?
That's the thing, isn't it? And that's the question that we're asking. Would you start him? And Andy summed it up when he says, I don't know. There's one thing, though, I think we can all agree, and all the fans listening to this will agree as well. We really hope that he adds to his Manchester derby moments this weekend.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We're going to move it on from talking about Rashford now. We're going to talk about great Manchester derby memories that we've all got. Andy, I'll let you kick this off because you've got the deepest track record history of us all, considering you're older.
Young.
So, what would you go for? What's your best memory?
Getting beat at Main Road about 1990. Brian McClair scoring a couple of goals, getting a free-all draw, actually, so it's not even a win. 93, 2-0 down, City fans singing 2-0 up and you effed it up. Galatasaray, because Manchester United had gone out of Europe, and then Roy Keane and Cantona combining for Manchester United to win 3-2. That was brilliant. I think the 5-0 at Old Trafford in 94. I will move away from the early 90s. I'm not stuck in that era, trust me. I think that finally got rid of the 5-1, which was September 89. That was huge. I mean, for years, City fans would taunt me and just go 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-3-4, 5-1. That's all they had for a long time. The Michael Owen game, there's been so many. The Wayne Rooney game. I love it when we beat City away. I used to love going to Main Road. It was a proper football ground in the middle of inner city, Moss Side. It was a pretty unforgiving place to go to. There's been some terrible Manchester derbies as well. And I can remember for a long time thinking it doesn't live up to the hype compared to the great derbies of world football. And I've been fortunate enough to travel to them. It's not actually that good. The games are pretty disappointing. The atmosphere's not as good as Mancunians might like to think it is. But there's been some decent moments. In more recent times, I thought United's best performance of the 18-19 season was away at City. Absolutely blitzed them. That was the most idealised version of, I think, what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wanted his Manchester United team to be. Just lightning quick, attacking against the one of the best two teams in the league and blitzing them. But
one of my earliest memories of going to the match with my dad was the 5-0 against City. I can remember vividly after the game going back down onto the concourse, and there was a guy sat with the biggest grin you've ever seen, banging on top of a plastic bin. 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2-3-4, 5-0. And it makes sense now, you saying that that's what the City fans did to you, because clearly that guy had probably had it all the time in those, what, 4 or 5 years since that game as well. City fans saying the same thing to him. And that's a brilliant memory. That's one of my earliest memories of going to the game at Old Trafford. Laurie?
Memories. The one that stands out for me is the 4-2 in the FA Cup. I didn't go to many Manchester derbies because City weren't really around in the top flight when I was growing up. But yeah, that 4-2 one was one that I actually went to with my dad. And, you know, obviously Gary Neville gets sent off, doesn't he, in the first half. I've just refreshed my mind in preparation for this podcast. I watched it back and it is quite funny. You know, Neville goes for the dive over Tarnat, tries to win a penalty, slaps the turf in frustration. I'd love to see, you know, when he's calling out players for diving now on Monday Night Football or whatever. Jamie Carragher should just relay this video, because then McManaman comes in. And I think because, you know, you've got the whole perhaps Liverpool element to it with Steve McManaman. Gary Neville sees red, headbutts him. Jeff Winter's there, you know, as the referee, trying to grab him, get him out of the mix and sends him off. Gary Neville sort of protests for a brief moment and then sprints down the tunnel. So it is a funny episode. And you kind of, I remember being in the stands at the time thinking, this is an FA Cup game. You know, it's kind of, it meant a bit at the time, because United weren't exactly, you know, riding high in the Premier League. And so it kind of had a bit more importance to it. And obviously you've got, you know, the big end of City fans. It, you know, there's much more animosity, isn't there, when it's an FA Cup tie. And United just blitzed them 3-0 up with 10 men. Ended up being 4-2, great game. So that's kind of one that stands out in my mind. And then I realised there's another 4-2 that I went to under Van Gaal. Do you remember this period?
Yeah, Fellaini.
It was like a halcyon period where they had like 3 or 4 wins in a row, didn't they? Villa, Liverpool, I think. When it seemed
started
with the
Spurs,
clue,
didn't it? When Rooney did his boxing celebration. It was that little run,
wasn't
it?
Was that the one?
I think it started with that.
Yeah.
Right, I'm going on here now. I'm having a look. You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
3-0 Tottenham, 2-1 away at Liverpool, 3-1 at home to Villa, and then 4-2 at home to Man City. And wasn't this the period where he had like Ashley Young, Ander Herrera and Marouane Fellaini on the kind of left flank, like, and it was like this triangle
of players.
There was
a triangle on the left and a triangle on the right that just worked at the time, wasn't there?
It was crazy, period, wasn't it? And we thought he'd unlock the code for United being successful. And
Ashley
then
Young
the next
and Marouane Fellaini keeping Di Maria and Falcao at the time.
Yeah, pretty much.
What
it was beautiful.
Carl?
How do we pick a modern one? Go to university around about 2009. This is when I start going to pubs and being able to watch Sky easier. So that little period where City are slowly rising and slowly competing for FA Cups and slowly competing for Premier League titles, I remember those games quite vividly. Rooney Shinner. I mean, he was having a terrible game, and it is a Shinner, but still it's beautiful. It sticks in the memory. The 4-3 sticks in the memory. Just sort of Rio Ferdinand's light relief when Michael Owen scores. One that does stick in was the 3-2 where Van Persie scores in the last minute, because I broke my laptop celebrating it. So this was, I just graduated and I didn't go to the pub. I watched it via certain streaming methods, shall we say. And Van Persie lines up for the free kick, and I didn't realise how delayed my stream was. And my mate is looking at his phone, he's going, I think you've won this game. I'm like, yeah, whatever, not paying attention to it. Van Persie scores his free kick going over. I think Nasri ducks out the way. And like,
oh, Nasri got dog's abuse for that.
Yeah.
For quite some time.
Mancini called him like half a man or something. Says half a man in the wall.
Yeah.
And it
was the polite version, I think.
And it goes in. And I sort of had my laptop. I was like, yeah. Just like screaming and shouting. And I basically throw the laptop in the air. And I drop it. And I've realised what I've just done. I've broken my Dell laptop, going, it's worth it. Derby, United are going to win.
I interviewed Rooney and Van Persie off the pitch that day in the tunnel at Manchester City after United had done that. That was one of the highlights of me covering matches early on. People still laugh at me for my face when the game happened at Old Trafford where City scored quite a few goals and United scored one. And I just looked absolutely miserable. Also, going to the last derby at Main Road in the Gene Kelly stand in the corner and getting absolutely soaked with my dad, and then getting locked in at the end just to top it off, because that was around the time that lock-ins were first sort of getting popular. That was dreadful. I took a job in the burger bar at City, putting blue ketchup on burgers and hot dogs for a couple of months just so I could get in to watch the first Manchester derby at the City of Manchester Stadium, as it was called then. And obviously you had to work before the game and up to half time, and you were free just after half time. Went and found a steward that I'd made friends with. He told me where there was a seat to watch it. I sat down. I think it was 2-1 at the time. United had scored towards the end of the first half to get back in the game. And then Trevor Sinclair scored and everyone jumped all over me, and I just didn't know what to do. And in the end, I left before Sean Wright Phillips scored the fourth, because it was pretty much the worst experience of watching Manchester United play anywhere, being jumped on by excitable City fans. Another one that really sticks in my mind, another period, was 2009-10. We talked a little bit already about the 4-3, but Manchester United had a run of three games where they scored 90th minute winners against Manchester City in that season. The first game was the 4-3, of course, where Michael Owen scored in stoppage time. But then they played each other in the semi-finals of the EFL Cup as well, or whatever the League Cup was called back then. United obviously lost away at the Etihad and then won 3-1 at home, and Wayne Rooney scored the winner in stoppage time that day. And then just to top it off, this was sort of peak noisy neighbour time as well, and United silencing them, in the words of Ferguson. The third game, it happened again, didn't it? Paul Scholes scored the winner in stoppage time at the Etihad. I just remember thinking that that would never end, really, and obviously it has.
That game in January 2010 was the first time I thought City have got a proper side here. If we're going to go on low points, the FA Cup semi-final at Wembley. Absolutely. A year later, because I thought City are going to probably win something here. But the atmosphere at Old Trafford for that second leg of the League Cup game, City had the whole of K Stand. I was in K Stand, so you could look up and see them right above you. It was brilliant. And I know we were going to touch on how City support has changed. And I think it has changed. And I'm from a part of Manchester where it's overwhelmingly United, and the City fans call themselves Blues in Bandit Country, Stretford and Urmston. And they're proper Blues. They've gone to the match for years and years. And I always respected them as football fans, even if we just used to hammer them and take the piss out of them because they were going to Grimsby and we were going to Juventus away or whatever. And I just find my relationship with them, we just don't talk about football, which is bizarre. And some of these lads are some of my best mates. I just think, I don't know if we're being really immature, that we won't find any common ground. And it's definitely changed. And I also know some City fans who go everywhere with City, and my sister married one of them, and I'm on about, if City play in Moscow behind closed doors and get ordered not to go, they'll still go. And I sense some disillusionment among them because City have changed, and they're blinded by this brilliance because the football is brilliant, but it has come at a cost for them. They've lost something of the old City, and I think some of them miss that. I think on balance, most of them really enjoy what Manchester City have become, but something has been lost of the old City, and the demographics of the fan base are definitely changing as well. They're averaging over 50,000. They're better supported now than at any point in their history, and from a footballing perspective, they have been exceptionally well run, and Guardiola is a brilliant manager. And Manchester United could have learned from the way they have been run from a football perspective, from their recruitment perspective. They're going to Benfica, they're getting Ruben Diaz, they're paying top dollar, of course they are, but their recruitment has been much smarter than United, and that's why they've been winning the league. I don't pay that much attention to them. It might sound bizarre, and I just don't pay that much attention to him, but this weekend I will be with some nervousness. In fact, I'm saying this, I'm putting my hand on my head, aren't I? Because I'm nervous about it.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh Football Club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Right, all right, then let's round off any other business. Laurie, you've been at Manchester United's UEFA League match this week. You've written about an interesting angle to it as well. It was a disappointing result, but your article on The Athletic has quite an interesting takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, I think the overall impression was quite a positive one from United's performance, you know, against Borussia Dortmund, who are, you know, a club that clearly has a lot of pedigree in terms of developing youth. That's the whole business model, isn't it? You know, might not produce all their own players, but they certainly buy at a young age, and they, you know, manage to get, you know, good price for them ultimately. And United with a better team, really. You know, they drew 2-2. Both of Dortmund's goals were counter attacks, which is a bit frustrating because I think United knew going in that that would be their sort of modus operandi. But I think there's some good moments. You know, Hannibal Mejbri, again, you know, got kicked quite a bit, but came through, sort of was really demanding the ball in those key areas. So I think he could be knocking on the door a little bit for maybe getting around the first team towards the end of the season. Just in a, I mean, he's training with them at the moment, but you sort of wonder if he could perhaps have some kind of impact, not like Anthony Elanga, but, you know, just get in the mix a little bit. Because Ralph Rangnick was there on Tuesday night in the stands alongside John Murtagh, Darren Fletcher. So it was a good turnout. Anthony Elanga was there as well. He'd scored in this competition earlier in the season. So you can see the development from him. And therefore, I think the players that played in this game actually have a genuine, you know, prospect of doing something in future at United. The other two that I would probably pick out, Alvaro Fernandez, the left back, he's had a really good season. And also Alejandro Garnacho, who's the sort of left winger, he's you know, rapid, and he'll be in the FA Youth Cup as well, which is on Wednesday against Wolves at Old Trafford. So another chance to see this kind of crop of players. But yeah, the angle that I sort of took from it a little bit was that, yes, United are, you know, steeped in history when it comes to the academy, but in recent years, have they absolutely used it as a way of just, you know, adding up, topping up the kind of budget, really, I suppose, because there was a report that came out last week from the Football Institute, the Football Observatory, where it sort of ranked United as basically bottom, top 50 it was, but United were snuck in there 50th in terms of how much money they've sort of sold academy players for in the past 6-7 years, it is, since July 2015. So when you look at the likes of Man City, you know, I think United's total was €60 million, Man City's was €140 million, and it sort of shows, I suppose, that, you know, there is scope perhaps for United to get a bit better there in that situation. I know that people will say, well, actually, United are producing players for the first team, you don't want to be selling these players actually if they're good enough, but I think there's clearly sort of a middle ground where actually, if United kind of, you know, realise that these players perhaps won't make it at United, get a good price for them, move them on to a good club that's beneficial for their careers, and then you can sort of recoup a bit of money, and then hopefully that goes into the transfer budget for the first team. So that was kind of where I was getting at with the piece. And listen, the game against Dortmund was just a snapshot of where United are at, but I think it was a good point at which to kind of bounce off and go, okay, where's the United Academy looking at, and what can we see in the future?
Go and have a look at Laurie's piece if you want to read more about that. Carl, you've been writing about who Manchester United's free kick taker should be. Big question.
Yeah. So there was a moment again in the first leg against Atletico Madrid where Cristiano Ronaldo stood over a direct free kick and I very strongly went, just get him off it. No. He hasn't scored a direct free kick in, well, at time of recording, 607 days. And that is, I think he's now taken 59 free kick attempts without scoring. And something I did find mildly interesting in the 0-0 draw against Watford was there was a rather presentable free kick from about 35 yards out that he walked away from. He left it to Bruno Fernandes and Alex Telles. And Telles took the free kick. He's left-footed and he scored three free kicks for Porto. So I look at the numbers, did a little bit of assessment, had a look at some of the free kick goals that Bruno Fernandes has scored because I thought his free kick technique is quite interesting in that it looks like he's going to try and do it one way, but he actually borrows a lot from the, if you are a listener of a certain age, I remember indirect free kicks and how everyone used to take them in around like the 90s and 2000s. He takes them a bit like that as well. So I think I know the hierarchy and who should be taking free kicks for Manchester United now. So give it a look.
Well, if you want to know the answer to that, you know what you need to do. Andy, you've been meeting Lee Sharp, haven't you?
Yeah, I went to see Lee and ahead of the game in Atletico, and I'm just transcribing it and writing it up now, and there's a lot of words there. He was really good. He was really good value. And I sat down and one of his mates just brought me a pint over after 5 minutes. And I just thought, no, I'll be really professional here and just have a coffee for now. And he's great company. And I noticed last week, Roy Keane picked him out as someone who he'd most like to go to a party with. Of course, Lee was a good looking lad, but I find him, when I'm going through the transcription, which sometimes as a journalist, you can come away from an interview thinking that was really good. And then you transcribe it and you think, actually, he's not said anything that's that interesting there. I'm finding that that's not the case with Lee Sharp. And there's a huge response when I said that I've just interviewed him on Twitter. Huge response. And I think that the Class of 92 lads and Beckham, their profiles went collectively and individually to a really, really high level. But Lee was a big, big star just before those lads came through. And I enjoyed making the effort to go and speak to him face to face, and I hope that people who subscribe to The Athletic will really enjoy reading the interview.
Yeah, sounds like something to look forward to. It's been brilliant to do this with the three of you. I'm sure everyone listening has enjoyed it as well, so thank you very much for being on with us, and also for you guys at home for listening as well. If you want access to any of the articles that we've spoken about on the podcast, remember, there's that offer on at the moment. You can subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month for the first 6 months. Go to theathletic.com/ManUnitedPod. We'll be back on Monday to react to the Manchester derby. Let's hope we've got something worth reacting to. See you then.
The Athletic.